We have another guest standing by, and that's Dr. Andrew Fall. He's a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies, and I think it's important. I mean, it's something that we've been discussing for some time, which is, of course, the fact that we have a really difficult state of policing. And this is something that Andrew has actually looked into. He was recommended to us by one of you saying, please, won't you reach out to Dr. Andrew Fall and don't just speak to the politicians. And so I'm very eager to hear his perspective. Dr. Fall, senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies Justice and Violence Prevention Program. Good morning. Welcome to Breakfast with Refilwe. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Refilwe. I'm great. Thanks. How are you?
Excellent. So what began as a conversation about the budget cuts that might have been the impetus to our inability to respond to some violent actions, and I suppose on a more grand scale, the difficulty with keeping law and order within the country in general has morphed into this discussion. And I'm so grateful for our listener who pointed us in your direction. What is your take on the South African policing state?
Well, I don't think there's a simple answer to that. I think our police definitely could be better. They could also definitely be worse. So we shouldn't complain too much. I think it's worth asking the question, do South African police make the country safe? But it's equally worth asking, what would the country look like without police? And there are directions in which to move for both those answers. I think if we look at what is spent on policing, how many members we have in the South African Police Service, the amount of time and activities that are carried out, we aren't getting a decent reward on investment. We've got roughly 96 billion rand being spent, almost 400 million hours of work time, almost 200,000 employees, and millions upon millions of reported activities. And we still clearly feel safe. We are unsafe. We see violent crime in particular continuing to increase. So in that sense, it's not great. And I think there are some moves that could be pursued to improve things, but there isn't a quick and simple solution, in part because of the politics that has made policing so messy for more than two decades now.
Yeah, the politics gets very murky, but you like to take a very data-driven approach, and sort of, I guess one could say, a clinical approach, and critical thought approach to policing. Let's say it's a blank slate and it's up to us to take a snapshot of violent crime and other kinds of crime in South Africa. What would be the data-driven response? Where should the emphasis be in South Africa when it comes to policing?
Sure, yeah. So the project that I lead at the ISS is based on promoting the use of evidence in policing in South Africa. So if we think of the way that evidence is used in relation to the COVID pandemic, we can say what evidence exists that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is more effective than the Pfizer vaccine, for example. And then we could look at lab-based and experimental evidence to answer that question. We don't do the same in policing very often. In fact, we don't do the same in governance in general. Although government has rhetorically had an evidence-based approach to governance for many years, and it does in many ways, including the SAPs, have impressive performance monitoring systems, the systems don't allow us to draw a direct link between variation in police activity and variation in outcome. And that's what we want to be doing. So we want to be careful empirical observation to see what changes in police activities bring about different outcomes. In terms of the evidence that exists predominantly from other countries, it would suggest that we could be most effective by being very intentional in targeting things. So rather than booking members on duty and saying, okay, drive around, be visible, things will happen, we should rather have very clear theories of change, so very clear logic in our head that says, by doing this activity, we will disrupt this mechanism, which is causing this harm. And then we've got a hypothesis which we can test through our police activities. And
what would that be in practical terms, Doctor?
In practical terms, we would say, okay, there are 100 murders happening in this area every 6 months. 60 of those murders are happening over weekends, and 40 of them are happening in these micro locations in an area. So by addressing those 40 murders in micro locations, we can bring down the overall murder far more effectively than if we try to address the whole area at once. And so in so doing, by being intentional and targeted, we can much more rapidly see an overall improvement in public safety.
Oh, wow. So you're saying like investigative policing, like using intelligence and, I don't know, detective work.
There would be different ways. So as with many things in the social world, there's this kind of 80-20 idea, so that 80% of violent crime is generated by 20% of the population. So there would be a small group of repeat violent offenders who, in theory, one could identify, target, and address in one way or another. And that doesn't mean only using blunt criminal justice tools to remove potential offenders. We can use the broader social welfare system to provide alternatives. And that's one way in which we could better integrate our criminal justice system into a more holistic public safety approach. My voice. So one can identify them with intelligence-driven policing, but one can also provide clear deterrence. So rather than saying we will do this idea of visible policing, I think is a bit misleading in South Africa. The idea that if we had quote-unquote visible policing, there would be less offending. We aren't all rational offenders. We don't walk around making careful calculations about things. But we do know that most harm occurs in isolated areas, and we can direct attention to those areas, be that in the form of visible policing, but very intentional visible policing, such as stopping in an area and having conversations with people, or doing particular stops and searches, not random stops and searches, or providing urban upgrading to areas where there are risk factors in the built environment.
Dr. Fall, I mean, I imagine visible policing also works in a society where people are afraid of the police, which I don't think is one that we're dealing with.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Visible policing works in a society that's afraid of the police, right? I'm not convinced from what we see. I mean, particularly if you look at footage from the other weeks ago, but in various footage, actually, I've seen people stealing cables in Matatiele right in front of the police, and police having to sort of wrestle them for the cables. It doesn't make sense to have visible policing if people aren't afraid of the fallout of police visibility.
Yeah, I mean, I would say we don't want to promote fear of police. We want to promote respect for the rule of law and the recognition that the police represent a system which will provide consequences. But I think if we start using the word fear, we're in promoting abuse and things. But I hear what you're saying. People don't necessarily see police as people they need to respect or respond to or change their behavior in response to. But I don't think it's as simple as saying we haven't consented to being police, which is something that is sometimes said. I think most South Africans do adhere to the law. We do respect what the police stand for in terms of the state. But if I am somebody who, for whatever reason, needs to feels like I need to break the rule and disregard the state in a particular moment, and that's slightly different. Yeah, but I don't think it's as simple as rational offenders and deterrence.
Correct. I was agreeing with you on that. So Dr. Andrew Fall is who I'm speaking to. He's a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies, helping us understand how the current state of policing in South Africa. Doctor, one of the things that you sort of indicated was, okay, and I was being sarcastic earlier on when I was saying, oh, wow, like detective work. The reason I'm being sarcastic is that the refrain we often hear from SAPS, right, when we speak about, for example, extortion and the broadening extortive rackets that are moving from very organized crime to petty criminals taking part in this in neighborhoods across the Western Cape, is that they can't make a move until someone makes a complaint, which of course is very difficult, for example, in the case of extortion, wherein people fear for their lives if they whistleblow. And they're often being extorted by people who are in their neighborhoods who know them well. And I find it, you know, and I always say that maybe I've watched too much Law and Order or too many cop shows from other countries. But how is it that South Africa operates from this we can only be reactive perspective, as opposed to getting intelligence on a community, particularly where crime happens to happen, and trying to be preventative?
Yeah, I think there's a balance in the response. I think it is very difficult for South African police to move forward on certain things when people don't lay formal complaints. But at the same time, we shouldn't allow that to create an organizational culture which lets people use that as an excuse never to act. So if there's an accusation about criminality within the South African Police Service, and for legitimate reasons, police officials don't want to go on record against their colleague, an internal investigation or anti-corruption unit would build a case. So you take the information provided and you carry out a sting op type thing. So you build a case, the state becomes the complainant, and the South African Police Service could do much more of that. But I think there is a challenge of an organizational culture that says something, if somebody doesn't want to complain, then we won't open the case. So police can come across a really violent assault in progress, but if the victim doesn't want to open a case and they rather just want to go to hospital, police might just leave that and not open the case.
Yeah, but
I think that is problematic.
For me, that's a problem. So it's not just about the cases that get completed. It's about creating the environment that's safe. So if I am actually detecting either robberies in an area or detecting potential murders in an area, that doesn't necessarily, you know, aren't they able to position themselves to put in preventative measures, is what I'm saying, never mind following one case to its conclusion?
I think there definitely needs to be a change, and part of that change needs to see policing better integrated with other departments, as I say. So if police officials feel like the only thing in their toolbox is arrest or kind of the abusive use of violence against people accused of crime, then that's not going to work. But if police know, okay, I can call the social worker, I can divert this person to this environment, I can call on the city to improve the lighting, then things would be much more effective. But as long as police officials think they've got very limited tools, and as long as they think they are bound by unrealistic performance targets to bring reported crime down, right, to improve their response times, etc., they are incentivized not to record crime. They're incentivized not to act on information because they aren't being evaluated on measures of fear and safety. They're being evaluated on much simpler metrics. And so that performance environment, that organizational culture needs to be aligned with what we all really want, which is just publicity and improved feelings of security.
Right, and that's, I mean, globally, I mean, a large part of the defund the police movement is around not just saying defund the police for the sake of it, but actually putting emphasis on social, guardrails, but a safety net that kind of deters people from that criminal activity in the first place. Just, you made a very interesting point, Doctor, a little bit earlier on about people's sense of respect of law. Respect for the rule of law, rather. In some cities and countries, I'm thinking the Dennis Dinkins years, but I think Rudy Giuliani gets all the credit for it. Zero tolerance was something that was put in place where petty crime was focused on in the first place, and very harsh, or severe sanction for petty crime, which kind of it was seen as a gateway to more violent and bigger crime. Is that something that South Africa could approach to restore the respect for rule of law, or has the horse bolted?
I think the New York example is often misrepresented in the public, and there's a popular culture notion of it which isn't actually accurate. And I can't get into the details now, but the founder of the kind of problem-oriented approach to policing, which is what is often called zero tolerance, was George L. Kelling, and he provided the ideas that one deals with the environment, one deals with the low-lying drivers of bigger crime, and you address those before bigger things happen. But simplifying it down to simple offenses, so somebody urinating on the street or washing windows or littering needs to be addressed harshly, and that's going to address everything. That I don't think is accurate, and I don't think that's what we need to do in South Africa in particular, because it's really punishing the poor, and we have many more poor than Manhattan had in the 80s.
Yeah, and we're seeing them being criminalized in the Western Cape, so yeah.
But what we can do in terms of that is take the problem-oriented approach, and that is saying, okay, we're seeing, if we use the Manhattan example, we're seeing intersections as a problem because there are window washers and they are linked to criminality, etc., etc. So how do we address that problem without criminalizing everybody? And how you address it is you take your window washers, you provide them with alternative forms of income or alternative ways to make their money that aren't going to be linked to offenses, or you change the way that traffic lights are working so that people aren't stationary. So I think a problem-oriented approach is what I was referring to earlier in terms of everything needing to be targeted, linked to a clear logic of, we believe that this is the mechanism causing harm and we're going to disrupt that mechanism by doing A, B, and C. That is certainly something we need. It's something which has been on SAP's policy books for many, many years. It's built into the idea of sector policing. But again, the performance environment in the South African Police Service is one that doesn't allow police, even motivated police who really want to do these things, it doesn't allow them to focus and reach out to and engage with other departments in the way that is often envisaged in their own policies and practice. And this isn't simple. It's not, I mean, pointing out that they can't do it isn't isn't necessarily a criticism, but I think there is a need from politicians, from the different tiers of government, and within the South African Police Service to acknowledge this and to say, how can we work together to create the spaces in which we can take these policies that we've had on paper for many, many years and allow our officials to use them. And we don't have to do that across the country, but we can say, okay, we've got this great vision. Let's pilot it in a small town somewhere and see if we have these results, because clearly what we are doing isn't producing the results we want. So, and this goes back to the evidence-based policing approach. Let's take a hypothesis. Let's test it somewhere where we aren't going to change everything, throw the baby out with the bathwater, but we can learn lessons. And if those lessons work, we try them elsewhere. And we move like that rather than constantly changing whole policies and trying to change policing across the country in one fell sweep.
Thank you so much, Dr. Andrew Fall, Senior Researcher at the Institute for Security Studies, a view, studies justice and violence prevention.